Blog Talk Radio.
Special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
What's up? What's good with everybody? You're here live on the Go Long Media Channel on Blog Talk Radio, and this is the Boxing Source Radio Show. I am your host, James Bell, lead boxing analyst for the Cold Hard Truth on Sports. You know, articles on boxing and more at thechtonsports.com. That is thechtonsports. Number to dial in to talk live, 347-237-5539. That is 347-237-5539. Press the one key to get on cue, and you'll be able to talk live on the show. We got like a very busy show scheduled tonight. A lot of things to talk about, a lot of things to go through, and we're going to see if we can go through as much of it as we can in this show. So we're going to have pretty much a one-hour live session to go through everything. And from that, we'll be able to break down all the major matchups and fights that happened basically last night. Starting off with the fight card that was in the O2 Arena by Matchroom Boxing. We also, you know, had a few other promotional companies involved, including headed by David Higgins particularly for the main event, which was Dylan White versus Joseph Parker. We have that to basically cover, but wanted to get into a couple of fights that did happen as part of the undercard. Particularly one that was of interest to a few in the heavyweight division. You had the heavyweight contenders Derek Chisora and Carlos Takam as part of the fight card. Carlos Takam, of course, was formerly the number two contender for the IBF heavyweight championship, and he ended up facing Anthony Joshua for that IBF title alongside the WBA super championship and IBO championship, and ended up getting stopped. This was basically his next challenge over in the O2 after being in Cardiff for that fight against Anthony Joshua. He was going up against Derek Chisora. Derek Chisora, of course, a Del Boy. Heavyweight contender there was, you know, had a few tough fights, a few tough losses, particularly against Dylan White at one point. But he came in there you know, with a record of 28 wins and 8 losses. And had already had a fight, you know, in March of this year where he got a TKO victory there, but had a, you know, string of losses. Like I said, you know, the fight with Dylan White, which was a split decision loss. Some people thought that he won that fight against Dylan White. He also had, like, a majority decision loss against Isaac Caballo for a European title. And he did fight face Kubrat Pulev before losing to Dylan White. So you had, you know, basically that where, you know, Tyler Sackham, like I said, lost to Anthony Joshua, lost to former WBO champion Joseph Parker, lost to former WBA regular champion Alexander Povetkin. Yeah, also had like a loss earlier in his career. So this fight was, you know, something to focus for like a lot of people. So it was a fight that was kind of like a crossroads, particularly for Derek Chisora, you know, being with the record that he had. So, I mean, here it was, you know, something to see where you had two heavyweights basically going at it. And, you know, in that particular fight, it was, you know, for some, you know, they felt like that that fight kind of like was a show stealer, because you had, you know, at one point Derek Chisora in trouble, where he was, you know, kind of like down, but then he was able to come back, pull back into the fight, get back into it, pretty much in the second half of the fight, around the sixth and seventh rounds and such. Then, you know, in the eighth round, he was able to, you know, get in the gear and you know, pick up the pace against Carlos Sackham and, you know, scored a, you know, knockdown, first scored a knockdown in the eighth round when he had Carlos Sackham in big trouble. Sackham got a 8 count for that. And then, you know, the next, once he, after he took that 8 count, he got up and Derek Chisora, you know, walked in and gave Sackham another right hand that put Sackham down on the canvas, flat on his back. And the referee didn't necessarily give a count. He ended up stopping the fight. So, you had Derek Chisora end up getting the win by basically TKO in the eighth round to move into the win column there. So what you had is him, you know, move or improve his record, basically. With that, he gets the 29th win of his professional career and gives Carlos Sackham his 5th professional loss. Now, like I was mentioning before, you had Carlos Sackham there as someone who, like I said, built up to the IBF number 2 ranking. Also was rated highly by independent boxing organizations, such as the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board and Premier Boxing Organization, being, you know, among the top 10 fighter, probably not through the Premier Boxing Organization at the time, because before his loss to Anthony Joshua, he was ranked 9th in the heavyweight division. He probably dropped from 9th after his loss to Anthony Joshua. But Like I was saying, you had other boxing organizations that had Carlos Takam as a high-ranking fighter. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens here with this, you know, win by Derek Chisora over Carlos Takam, and where that places Derek Chisora in, you know, sports boxing organizations. You know, maybe, you know, particularly the IBF or like the WBO, see if he'll be, you know, ranked within the top five or so, because, you know, you had, you know, that be a key fight for both fighters. And, you know, one guy is able to, you know, get the win there. So I'd like to see what happens, you know, with Derek Chisora, as he's going to be able to, you know, improve his status, you know, in as a, you know, basically as a heavyweight fighter out there. So that's, you know, something that we're going to be looking at here in the near future, where, you know, he's going to be placed in these boxing organizations. What I'm trying to do is, you know, pull up where you had, yeah, Carlos Takam was rated number 6 in the IBF after his loss to Anthony Joshua. I see him at number 14 in the WBC. Derek Chisora was right at number 11 in the WBC. I was trying to see if he was rated somewhere else, but no, they don't have Chisora rated anywhere else in the boxing organization. So he'll probably improve his status a little bit in the WBC and probably, you know, into the ranking in the IBF with this win over Carlos Takam. So that's what we got going on so far with that particular matchup. So, you know, that's, you know, real quick, you know, analysis of the fight between Derek Delboy Chisora and Carlos Takam. You know, you also had, as far as, like, overall results are concerned from those two, is, you know, you had Conor Benn end up getting the win over Cedric Maynard. You had Joshua Boxy get a win over Andres Popomeko. And also, you had the unified female lightweight titles on the line, as you had Katie Taylor defend her title against Kimberly Connor. So she had the IBF and the WBA female lightweight title. So, you know, this was the first defense of her unified titles against Kimberly Connor. Of course, she was coming in there 9-0. You know, of course, with the last fight over Victoria Bustos winning that IBF female lightweight title. So you had those two things that she had going up against Kimberly Connor, who came in there with 13 wins, 3 losses, and 2 draws. So, yeah, it's just a thing real. She's having that. Taylor's having a few chance of those 5 titles. And it's basically a fairly easy fight for Katie Taylor. So, she ended up, you know, getting through or going through Kimberly Connor, getting the 3rd round TKO victory Moved to 10-0 in her professional career with that first defense of that IBF title. And this is, you know, fairly of note. Of course, Katie Taylor is, you know, one of the highly regarded female boxers out there in the sport. So that's something to where we are going to see if she is going to be regarded as, you know, one of the best pound-for-pound female fighters in the sport. You know, you have her as what I would say the kind of like, you know, one of the boxers that are discussed, you know, alongside, the welterweight champ, Cecilia Bracus, and also with, you know, Clarissa Shields as the middleweight champion, unified middleweight champ. So that's something to, you know, basically look at as, you know, who would be among the best female fighters that are out there. So thing to, you know, kind of like look through here. So that's another thing that's, you know, that we are looking into. Now, just wanted to, you know, get into the main event of what happened at the O2 Arena in the UK, as you had Dillian Whyte taking on Joseph Parker. And there, what you have is two guys that, you know, had one professional loss in their career. Hold on. A lot of background here. And both of these guys, you know, had the common opponent of facing and losing to Anthony Joshua. Of course, so Dillian Whyte facing Anthony Joshua first and losing there, while that was, you know, basically a KO loss to Dillian Whyte, Anthony Joshua, excuse me, and it was Joseph Parker facing Anthony Joshua earlier this year on March 31st in Cardiff. He ended up losing by unanimous decision there. So what we had is, you know, two guys, heavyweights, you know, amongst the top 10 in the heavyweight division, going at it, you know, having the fight there. And this is, you know, something to where you kind of like saw two guys, you know, in a really tough encounter, where you basically had, you know, Dillian Whyte, of course, has a lot of momentum ever since that loss to Anthony Joshua. You know, so the, you know, with that particular thing there, he eventually became the number one contender for the WBC heavyweight championship. But here it was kind of like a fight to where, you know, either he would keep his status there at number one in the WBC and, you know, eventually try to improve his ranking, you know, in other organizations. He was at the time number 7 in the WBA. He wasn't basically rated in the IBF. Number 2, you know, just right under Alexander Povetkin, who will be facing Anthony Joshua soon in, you know, Wembley Stadium. So here with this fight between Dillon White and Joseph Parker, I mean, we basically were looking for a big fight between the two, and we basically got what we asked for. And, you know, with that, you saw, you know, both of these guys, you know, not willing to back down from each other. Two guys that, you know, we kind of like saw with them that you had, you know, basically Dillon White kind of, you know, pull off a good start against Joseph Parker. You know, from there, you know, he got, you know, two knockdowns on Joseph Parker, as, you know, that was kind of like a first, you know, there, because, you know, he had never been knocked down before. But, you know, within the first round, so, you know, Parker had, like, a pretty good start, was, you know, pumping the jab against Dillon White, kind of like bothering him a little bit, and then it continued into the second round with his, you know, combinations there. But you had the, you know, first knockdown of a career in that second round. Kind of like looked very questionable, but either way, the referee, you know, counted there. Then, you know, it kind of like basically picked up for Dillon White, you know, even though he was kind of like being affected once again in the fifth round by Joseph Parker. But, you know, after that, you know, Dillon White kind of like put things up. And, you know, even though, like I said, Joseph Parker was still game, still coming after him, White was still, you know, hitting him. And then, you know, in the ninth round, Dillon White dropped Parker once again with a left hook. You know, basically was like a flash knockdown. That kind of like gave Dillon White the big lead going into the final round. But, you know, in the final, pretty much in the final two rounds, Dillon White was kind of like being fatigued. And Parker was basically going at it in the last couple of rounds. And, you know, in the 12th round, he did get a knockdown scored against him as Parker was able to drop him in the 12th. But he was able to, you know, basically get up from that and finish the fight. And just seeing here, excuse me there. But then you got the thing there where he was able to finish the fight, and the scorecards came in, and he got a unanimous decision victory with the scores of 113-112, 115-110, and 114-111 to move to 24-1 in his professional career and give the second loss to Joseph Parker. Real quick, I'm going to see if I can get someone on. Area code 205, what's going on with you?
What's going on, James? It's Mike Grady. How you doing?
Good. Just been very busy pretty much this whole weekend. You know, even with, you know, all the fights that were going on, you know, I was still able to catch all that I did. But just going through, you know, this White-Parker fight here first, what were you able to gather from that?
I actually just watched it, maybe like right before the show came on, because I didn't get an opportunity to watch it this weekend, so I just watched it. So my thoughts are fresh, but I would say that I'm surprised about the ultimate outcome in that, well, okay, I'm not surprised because Dylan White wanted the fight more. That's the first thing you could notice from the fight. Dylan White wanted the fight more. Dylan White won the fight because he jabbed more. And that was the difference between him, you know, after Joseph Parker lost steam after the first two rounds, Dylan White was still jabbing, trying to get in. Even though he was being judicious with the punches he threw, Joseph Parker didn't jab to keep Dylan White Dylan White off of him. So Dylan White was jabbing. He was able to get inside, and then that's when he landed, you know, like the hellacious punches that he did land. I just think I would have expected more. Like, Joseph Parker was lethargic, kind of like, did he make up an excuse? Because it looked like how Austin Trout looked when he was in his fight. Like, he just couldn't get more, you know what I'm saying? And that happened from round two, it looked like. Like, he was tired after round one or so. Like, in round two, you could see him kind of having his mouth open. He looked real, like, tired and stuff. And I'm wondering if he said that he felt, like, real drained or something. Or if he felt dehydrated, because he kind of looked just like
Austin
Trout. Well,
I'm not necessarily sure. I'm not sure if he, like, kind of did. He kind of, like, said the same thing after this fight that he said in the end of the Joshua fight. You know, basically that he gave his best and that, you know, his opponent was the better man, and that, you know, in his next fight, he'll come back stronger. So what he said after his loss to Anthony Joshua, and kind of like gives, you know, people the feeling that, you know, Parker wasn't completely into this fight, or, you know, completely into the fight against Anthony Joshua, to where, you know, he wanted to go out and get the win against either one of those guys. So I kind of felt that, you know, the way that he carried himself was, you know, very strange as far as, you know, someone who had been a, you know, former world champion. You know?
Yeah. I don't know. For you to say, I didn't watch the post-fight, but for you to say he said, I gave him my all, you know, I'll go to the drawing board. Like, I don't know. I think this even speaks to Anthony Joshua, too. Like, how good is Anthony Joshua, really? If Dylan White outboxed this dude. And let's say if Dylan White... Okay, first of all, Joseph Parker didn't have a lot of power, so Dylan White didn't really respect him, which allowed Dylan White to throw the counters that he threw when Joseph Parker was, like, throwing at him. And Joseph Parker came out pretty sharp early. He was throwing with a lot of speed. You know, he had a lot of intention on his punches, and then it looked like round two, he was winded. You know, like, it was the beginning of the end in round two, and then Dylan White just kept jabbing, started catching up with him. You got to give Joseph Parker some credit in that, you know, the last round when he did, when Dylan White was extremely tired, he tried to finish White, but I would say the more impressive thing was White's ability to persevere. That was more impressive. White was extremely tired, and you know, Joseph Parker was tired too, but White seemed to just, and even being exhausted, hurt, whatever you want to call it, he wanted it a lot more. And that'll take you a lot further than having more speed, more, I don't even know if we can say he had more skill, because Dylan White outright won this fight. Like, he did, like, the little tactics that you do, like pushing head down, you know, trying to headbutt him through the rope and stuff like that. I mean, that's not cool, but it is what it is. Like, okay, I got to give Dillian Whyte credit, too, because when he was hurt and he grabbed on those ropes, that was a very veteran move. Like, the ref was trying to get him off of him. He just held onto the ropes. He knew kind of where he was. He knew that it wasn't a lot of time left. Let me hold on to these ropes. Make the ref really have to take me off of this dude, you know? And that was a good move. I give a lot of props to Dillian Whyte. And, you know, I would be definitely interested in him fighting Anthony Joshua. Even though I did see the part where they was like, do you want to fight Anthony Joshua? And he kind of gave a not really answer. I got to go and, you know, to the drawing board and make sure I do some things that, you know, that I need to do in order to put me in a position to fight him. Like, he sounded like he wasn't trying to fight him. But if he box and stay away from Joshua's big punches, he should do well. I think all these guys get knocked out by Deontay Wilder. That's what this fight told me. Everybody gets knocked out by Deontay Wilder.
So, the thing is with Dillian Whyte, he did, you know, talk about maybe fighting Anthony Joshua at one point, you know, with it being like a local or kind of like, you know, an in-country rivalry between the two. So he didn't really necessarily mind having another fight with Anthony Joshua. But that still doesn't take away him in his, you know, wanting to fight Deontay Wilder. So that's one thing that we can't overlook. That, you know, with him being the number one contender for the WBC title, that he wants to, you know, still fight for a world title. Now, with, like I said, with Anthony Joshua fighting Alexander Povetkin, that kind of says that, you know, it takes away Povetkin as the top contender in the WBA and the WBO, which means that Dillian Whyte would be next in line to fight as the next highest ranked WBO contender. So, you know, another fight with Anthony Joshua, you know, would be a big, you know, big local clash, especially with the, you know, overall status that is there for Dillian Whyte right now. So that's something to look forward to in the near future. If, you know, we don't see Anthony Joshua versus Deontay Wilder on April 13, 2019 in Wembley Stadium, then you may see Anthony Joshua against Dillian Whyte there at Wembley Stadium. But like you were saying, it just seemed like Dillian Whyte really wanted the fight more, really wanted to make moves to get the win, and he, you know, took action to do so. You know, while Joseph Parker, you know, kind of like was almost, it almost seemed like he was there just to be there and not really, you know, take over and be the guy there to get another shot at a world title like he was, you know, initially talking about after his decision loss to Anthony Joshua. But, you know, with this performance, I'm not sure where he would get another opportunity to fight for a world title, because you, the way that he, you know, acted there, you don't really see him beating most of the guys that are, you know, closer to the top of the heavyweight division, and, you know, that doesn't include those that hold world titles. So that's you know, something that you kind of like look into here in the near future within the heavyweight division, and where, you know, Dillian Whyte will place himself, Joseph Parker will place himself, and then also with two other heavyweights that fought in that card in the 0-2. Now, seemed like you did get the news of that other fight that was in the heavyweight division at the 0-2 between Derek Chisora and Carlos Takam. And you had, I think you may have had something to say about one of those particular fighters. Would you want to expand on that?
I didn't watch the fight, but I think, what's his name, Matthew, who said that to come was, what did he say? Give me the verbatim what he said. I think you know it a lot better than I do. What did he say?
Well, that, you know, he didn't really put, you know, to come at, you know, such of a high level, because he was like saying, you know, what really makes to come be, you know, rated as a top 10 fighter. I mean, my thing is, like, he was basically there at the second tier of the heavyweight division. So, I mean, everybody that would be ranked above him has either, you know, already beat him or has, like, better wins than he does. So he's kind of like that next tier over, where, you know, you have him and, you know, likes of, like, a Dillian White, a Dominic Brazil, or someone like that, to where he kind of, you know, is there at top 10, but, you know, if you match him up against most of the other guys that were ranked above him, you wouldn't really pick him to, you know, win over those guys.
So I would say Dillian White is at the top of that second tier group. He's at the top of the second tier group. Chisora is not at the top of the second tier group. He may be in the second tier group, but I would say Brazil would beat Chisora. Brazil might even beat Dillian White. Maybe not, but maybe.
Interesting there.
Would you say Joseph Parker and
Terrell Miller at the in one rankings? They had Terrell Miller below Carlos Takam, along with Dominic Brazil.
Well, that ain't the case now. That's not the case now, because Terrell Miller would beat Chisora. Terrell Miller would beat the guy who just lost. Parker. Jarrell Miller would likely beat Dillian White too. Off of I don't know. Dillian White might be faster. I don't know. Jarrell Miller, his speed is elusive. Even though he's bigger, he got quick hands, I'll say, for him to be a bigger guy.
Yeah, he does. He does. He's able to, you know, be very active. Even though, you know, he kind of like hovers around 280 to 300 pounds out there in the ring. So that's something that, you know, we kind of like look at with Jarrell Big Baby Miller, is that, you know, even though, of course, he's big, he, you know, is very active as far as like letting his hands go at times. So a fight between him and Dillian White, you know, would kind of like be the measuring stick as far as like who the top of the second tier group of fighters are.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that statement you just made.
Yeah,
but I don't know. It's kind of disappointing with Joseph Parker. Is kind of disappointing, but I guess he is who he is. You know, his like lackadaisical demeanor is who exactly he was in the ring. He didn't, where you saw Dillian White fighting through adversity, that type of fighter, even though he like skirt the line with like cheap stuff, I would pick him all day against Joseph Parker, who, you know, when it's time to like kick it to that next level, he just would be content with finishing on his feet.
Mm-hmm. All right. Right.
Kind of disappointing.
And, and one of the things that, you know, I saw at the end of the fight with Sky Sports, you had David Hay out there with Tony Bellew, and Bellew's comment was that he felt that Dillian White was one of the top in the top tier of the heavyweight division, and that he would even say that Dillian White would defeat Alexander Povetkin, which I kind of was thrown off at, because Povetkin is who I would put in the top tier of the heavyweight division, you know, with, you know, the, of course, the two world champions. And, you know, for some, they put Luis Ortiz there, who we'll talk about in a little moment. But, you know, pretty much like right there after that is, you know, Alexander Povetkin. You know, of course, as a former world champion, you know, one guy that, you know, only has one professional loss to Vladimir Klitschko. So, you know, I kind of found that surprising that Anthony Bellew would say that Dillian Whyte would beat Alexander Povetkin.
So maybe you can inform me, but who has Povetkin beat to make him a world beater, to make him a top-tier fighter? Like, I get it. Experience. He's fought a lot of tough guys. He knocked out the dude who Deontay Wilder fought. He fought. Who else did he fight?
Duhapis, Marius Watts, Carlos Sakam, Manuel Char, who is, you know, currently the WBA regular champion now. Andrew Warzyk, who, you know, was a guy that Deontay Wilder was, you know, slated to face. Hasim Rahman back in 2012. Don't know why he fought Marco Huck, but he was able to do that. Ruslan Chagayev, also, who held the WBA regular title at one point. So a lot of those guys who are either, you know, former champions or eventually became world champions are, you know, amongst the guys on the list that Alexander Povetkin beat.
So outside of the old fighter, what's the old fighter name again?
Who, like Tony Thompson?
2012. He fought him in 2012. You just said his name.
Oh,
outside
Rahman.
Of him.
Or
outside of Rahman. Yeah, outside of him, everybody else would be a B-level, if even that, fighter. They would be in the second tier and not even high in the second tier. So I would question what makes Povetkin the top tier guy. What makes him really a top tier guy? And so I would question how interesting the fight between him and Dillian Whyte would be. Because I'm teetering to put Dillian Whyte myself in the bottom of the top tier or the top of the second tier.
So, yeah, it's kind of – it's basically, you know, a thing where you're in a division that really isn't that deep, so to speak. You know, it's not as deep as, you know, some of the other divisions that are out there, like maybe the middleweight division or the you know, junior middleweight division or the welterweight division, where you could name about six or seven or eight guys that could potentially beat any of those other eight guys, six or seven guys that are in that particular division. Here in the heavyweight division, all you have is, you know, one or two, you know, basically that could beat everybody. And that's pretty much it. So that kind of like summarizes the heavyweight division that's out there. But wanted to, you know, get into the next major card that was out there. That was at the Staples Center. Actually had the main event, lightweight unification title between Mikey Garcia and Robert Easter Jr. Real quick, you had Luis Ortiz taking on Ruslan Kajanu in the co-feature. Of course, Luis Ortiz contending for the WBC Heavyweight Championship over in the Barclays Center on March 3rd. Ended up getting knocked out by Deontay Wilder in the 10th round. So I was coming back here against Ruslan Kajanu. He was originally slated to face Joe Hanks, but, you know, I guess situations had Hanks be out of that. So Ruslan Kajanu was sucked into this particular fight. Kajanu hadn't fought since his unanimous decision loss to Joseph Parker for the WBO title at the time. So you had him, you know, basically in there in the ring, 16-3, going up against Luis Ortiz, 28-1. And, you know, for those that, you know, feel that Luis Ortiz is ranked among the best heavyweights in the world, he, you know, went in there to basically prove that against someone that, you know, many would feel that doesn't really belong in the ring with him. So he was able to easily score a KO win in the third round of that particular fight there. So that's what you had there with that quick. He basically made quick work of Kajanu. So real quick, Mike, what did you think about that there as far as like that first fight on Showtime?
I mean, the dude looked kind of like TV appearance wise. He looked sort of, he looked like he did stuff in the mirror. Like his movements, like he practiced his movements in the mirror. And then he tried to do, they said James Toney helped him out. You could see he did like the little looking thing James Toney did at one, in one of his fights. So in terms of trying to look good, you could tell somebody told him to look in the mirror and like look sort of like a, you know how Floyd Mayweather looked when he hitting the heavy bag and stuff. He looks well manicured and pedicured and stuff, and it just looked like flashy sort of. It looked sort of flashy. So the dude looked like that, but I think Luis Ortiz did the same move that Deontay Wilder does, the same move that Lomachenko does, the move where you throw, but Luis Ortiz did it differently. But Lomachenko throws a jab, pulls your hand down, then hits you with the other hand. Deontay Wilder throws a jab and kind of, it's like a half jab, half hook, but he throws a jab, a little wider jab. However he do it, he pull your hand down, hit you with the hook. Luis Ortiz threw a wide hook, and it looked like he was looking to pull his hand down with the hook and come right back behind it. But he was so far, like, position-wise, he was, like, in the perfect position that there was no way that he could not throw that next punch. Like, I don't know if the dude just – he just timed him really well, which probably happened. But, yeah, it was it was funny. It was kind of funny. But, I mean, I look forward to seeing Luis Ortiz.
Yeah, I mean, that type of maneuver works, you know, well for those that, you know, could kind of like a reach advantage or a significant reach advantage over your opponent. So, yeah, throwing out the jab or just pawing a jab out and then, like, instead of, like, throwing it straight out, throwing it, the jab straight out, you kind of like, I would say, throw it like, you throw it up, but it ends up downward. So when you throw it up, it originally looks like you're throwing it straight at the opponent, but you're throwing it downward so that when you throw it downward, it ends up like you said, getting the arm of the opponent. And when it does get the arm of that opponent there, you know, it basically opens them up to the right hand that comes after it. Or, you know, in the case with Luis Ortiz, it may have been like, you know, the left hand because he's southpaw. So, you know, he just basically used that in order to make quick work out of Radovan Kajanu and get the KO win there in the third, you know, basically the third round of there. So, you know, we get back into the win column, 29 wins and one loss there. And, you know, over the course of the week, he's been talking a lot. And, you know, right after the fight, he's been talking a lot. He's, you know, looking for a possible rematch against Deontay Wilder. You know, given with, you know, what people were talking about, you know, during the, you know, the round after he had Deontay Wilder in some trouble. But, you know, I don't really see what the overall point is for that particular fight to take place or for that particular rematch to take place there. So maybe with Luis Ortiz getting this win, see him, you know, in, you know, maybe some other boxing organization rankings, but well, except the WBA, I don't think he's going to be back in the WBA rankings anytime soon with his, you know, suspension. I think he was either permanently removed or he was suspended for a year after his second offense while being ranked in the WBA. So to me, I don't see why he wouldn't like take on somebody like, you know, Dominic Brazil or, you know, Dillon White. There was talk about Luis Ortiz fighting Dillon White, but, you know, Dillon White ended up fighting Joseph Parker, which, you know, probably ended up being a more lucrative fight for Dillon White there. So that's why he basically went that route. But it'll be something to see where Luis Ortiz goes next in his professional career. Now, quickly on to the main event. You had the unification bout between Mikey Garcia, WBC lightweight champion, and Robert Easter Jr., IBF lightweight champion. Both guys undefeated. Garcia at 38-0. Robert Easter Jr. at 21-0. And, you know, it was, you know, for the lightweight title. On Mikey Garcia's side, you had Robert Garcia as his trainer. And for Robert Easter Jr., he hired Kevin Cunningham to be there as the trainer for this particular fight. And so, you know, right off the bat, you kind of like seeing the overall differences between the two guys. Easter Jr., of course, with the height and the length, while Garcia was, you know, basically the guy that stands there right in front of you, looks at you, and just tries to get at you and get at you and get at you. And, you know, at first it seemed like, you know, Kevin Cunningham tried to utilize or, you know, implore for Robert Easter to get him to use a jab. And he used it a little bit, tried to pump a jab, like a double jab, a couple of times, you know, throwing one to the head and one to the body. But, you know, not necessarily following up with it, you know, or making Mikey Garcia pay for trying to get on the inside. Because once Mikey Garcia got to the inside, that's when, you know, Robert Easter basically got tattooed there. So, I mean, that was something to where, you know, at first he, you know, was able to get the, you know, knockdown, so to speak, and, you know, eventually, you know, get that momentum there. That kind of like showed the, I would say, the base for the fight, in that, you know, Mikey Garcia was just waiting, patiently waiting, looking at, studying what Robert Easter was doing, and then responding to what Robert Easter was doing. And I was just seeing, like, every time they were both close, that Easter was just getting blasted by left and right hands, particularly in the ropes. And then, you know, by the sixth or seventh round, the overall activity from Robert Easter Jr. Faded out. And so that was when, you know, Garcia clearly took over. You could see the overall effects on Robert Easter Jr.'s face. And, you know, by the 12th round, it was basically academic from there. And Mikey Garcia got the win with the scores of 118-109, 117-110, and 116-111. You know, basically, you know, having at least, what, you know, an 8-round win, a 9-round win, and a 10-round win on the judges' scorecards to take the IBF lightweight title from Robert Easter Jr. out there and stay undefeated, moving to 39-0. Real quick, Mike, what did you think about the fight?
I think it happened. The outcome was what I expected to happen. I think that I give a lot of props to Easter's team, and you got to give a lot of props to Easter for at least giving himself what I believe was in the direction of the best chance for him to win. As they said on the scorecards, first 5 rounds, it was tied. And, you know, it was definitely Garcia was the more skilled fighter. And over time, that skill showed, the difference in the skill level showed. I'd say Garcia was ultimately victorious outside of the skill because he effectively eliminated Easter's right hand due to, like, his defensive responsibility and responsiveness. He pretty much blocked every right hand that Robert Easter threw, and he almost immediately fired back when Easter threw a right hand. So he had Easter thinking about, should I throw this right hand? And anytime he threw the right hand, he blocked it or he either fired back. The one thing that I think hurt Robert Easter in this fight, which would have helped him, if he had better conditioning, like if he could have sustained it, and I hate saying coulda, woulda, shoulda, but in a scenario that's outside of this world and him not being who he is, if he had better win and he could have sustained that, then it would have been a lot more competitive fight. And Garcia probably would have only won maybe like a split decision, that type of win, a very close win. But
yeah,
the fact that he didn't have very good win, his lack of conditioning as compared to Garcia, that was his ultimate downfall. And so let's say idealistically, let's say in this fanciful scenario, if Robert Easter had better win, to me, the only tweak that I would have told him to do, you know, do the jabbing moving, but like Cunningham was saying, walk the dude into shots. So what he was not doing, like he would move when he was tired or whatever, but instead of him just moving, and Garcia would come, and then it would be that split second where Garcia would stop and get ready to throw punches. That's when he should have swung his hand, you know, and led him into the shot. Like he should have did some type of, like they should have explicitly worked on that. Keith Thurman is good at doing that type of stuff. Like, Keith Thurman will be moving left, right, you know what I'm saying? Like, he'll move in the corner, like, to not let you know where he's going. And then once you finally move in that direction, he'll move in the opposite direction, but he'll throw his hand with it and end up catching you. So the way that Robert Easter could have had his best opportunity to win if he had better win is if he did the whole jabbing and moving.
And
pretty much made Garcia have to come in, but then when Garcia did get in, he had to throw those 2 and 3 punch combinations and then keep on moving again. You know, that's exactly what Floyd Mayweather does, you know, to some extent, right? But, hit them before they stop and then make them reset and just keep jabbing and stuff.
You know, with Floyd Mayweather, jab where he does the lead right hand and moves out of the way. But like you were saying with Keith Thurman, you know, somebody that, you know, was, you know, kind of like under the tutelage of, you know, Cunningham, it's kind of like all Robert Easter had to do was, you know, utilize that same type of strategy. You know what I mean? And if he would be, you know, doing that, then all you would have seen was, like, what we should have saw from Robert Easter against, Robert Easter against Mikey Garcia was kind of like, you know, having what we saw in the previous week or so with, you know, Alexander Usyk being able to execute what he was able to execute against Murat Gassaev. Because with Usyk, Usyk had the reach, and Usyk was able to throw that jab, pump that jab, move, and, you know, Murat Gassaev was just right there. But also, with that, any attempt that Murat Gassaev had to try to get up close, Usyk would made him pay for it, and then still was able to get out of the pocket. So Robert Easton should have been able to do the same thing, and he was not able to do so.
But that win was gone after round 4-5.
Yeah.
He was just going off a fume. Garcia almost dang near stopped him. Like, literally, he almost stopped him. Like,
yeah.
It was to the point to where Robert Easter was literally, you know, like, you don't know if the headshots was hurting him per se, but it's
right.
Hard to tell when you barely can stand up and all somebody got to do is punch you and you fall over from exhaustion. Like, it's hard to say if the headshots was hurting him, but, I mean, Garcia definitely, you know, you got to give Garcia's credit. You got to give Robert Easter his credit, too, for at least sticking to the game plan. Like, that's the way that he normally fights is
mm-hmm.
different from how he fought this fight, and that's a testament to him moving forward and being a decent fighter even in losing this fight. Like, I think his career would be extended now, and, you know, like, he has the right person in front of him. Wasn't his dad giving him most of the instructions, and then Kevin Cunningham would say stuff after his dad would say something?
I mean, it probably was the case. They just had, you know, Kevin Cunningham in there during the training camp for, you know, him to prepare for this particular fight. But, yeah, you had Easton Sr. out there training little Bunny. But, you know, even with that, you know, you kind of seen him, you know, you seen Robert Easter do the things that he is supposed to do there at lightweight. And, you know, the way that, you know, he is, the way that his build is, that's what he's supposed to be doing at lightweight. It really doesn't, you know, make much sense for someone of his height and reach to not be able to utilize those to his complete advantage. And you didn't see that in his, you know, particular fights against Javier Fortuna, and you didn't really see it that much against Denis Shabakov, and where Easter got a unanimous decision, but, man, like, Shabakov was, you know, really outworking him in that particular matchup. So, at least here, he performed a lot better than those previous two fights, and hopefully that is something that he can work on here in the future. But, you know, with the guys that we have out there that hold the titles, like Vasyl Lomachenko and, you know, Ray Beltran, it's gonna be difficult to see where, you know, Easter Jr. Positions himself there in the lightweight division. Another guy that was, you know, there at lightweight that I felt really didn't use his height and reach very well was Rancis Barthelemy. He kind of, like, doesn't really do that very well. And, you know, he kind of got, you know, caught slipping against Carl Relic. And, you know, ultimately lost the second fight out there.
So I have a question.
Yep.
So you're telling me Mikey Garcia has two belts. The other two belts are owned by Vasily Lomachenko and Ray Beltran. Is that what you're telling me? So Mikey Garcia would rather move up and face Errol Spence because he feels like that's an easier fight than Lomachenko?
Nah, I thought he said that Lomachenko would be the easier fight than fighting Errol Spence. He said that he would be, you know, really excited for the challenge to fighting Errol Spence. This is what he was telling Kevin Ioli back in March, that, you know, Errol Spence basically brings the fight to you. He's right there ready to like swing and go and go. And that's what, you know, he's basically a fan of what he's looking for. He just feels that a fight against Lomachenko would be a much easier fight, which, I mean, if he feels that way, then that's okay. But, I mean, why not stay there at 135 and, you know, possibly have a shot to be the undisputed lightweight champion of the world? Yeah, I know Mikey Garcia had a lot of promotional contractual issues with Bob Arum in Top Rank, but, you know, if the opportunity presents itself to have, you know, Mikey Garcia there against Vasyl Lomachenko for the undisputed lightweight title and, you know, kind of like pound-for-pound supremacy, since a lot of people feel that Lomachenko is the best pound-for-pound fighter out there, which I'm not really giving them that. But, you know, even with that, you would still have a very big fight between those two in the lightweight division.
Yeah, definitely. Well, didn't he say something as in like as if he wanted Errol Spence after he won his fight?
Yes, he did. And, you know, particularly, you know, with the buzz that they say that fight is very possible, you know, with, you know, both of them, you know, being under the advisement of Al Haymon, is saying that is a very high possibility that fight can take place sometime in December. That is one thing that, you know, we're kind of like looking for, is if they actually do make that fight take place, especially with, you know, Errol Spence having a IBF title waiting on the winner of Danny Garcia and Sean Porter for that WBC welterweight title, and having the unification happen, you know, sometime next year, then what he could do is just basically wait it out and, you know, fight Mikey Garcia in the meantime.
So what was Spence's response? Because I know they interviewed him on the podium. I didn't hear the interview. What was his response to Mikey Garcia?
Well, I don't know what his exact response to Mikey Garcia is, but he probably says something like, well, I don't know, man. I mean, Mikey Garcia, man, he's a good fighter, man, and it would be a good challenge, man. Or he probably said something real, you know, real snappy on Twitter, because he usually, you know, after like every fight, it's particularly a fight that happens within his division, he'll like say something real quick. You know, like, for example, like after the Crawford Horn fight, or maybe the Garcia Brandon Rios fight or something like that. So, you know, I didn't really catch what he said, but he probably had something to the effect of him not minding challenging Mikey Garcia in the near future.
Gotcha.
Yeah. You know, with that, we pretty much in the overtime session of the show, basically like covered as much as I could cover with those two major cards. You did have something on ESPN Plus with the main event, Chris Diaz, undefeated, going up against Masayuki Ito from Japan. Chris Diaz is wanted to become, you know, another you know, world champion from Puerto Rico, held like the NABO super featherweight title, going up against Masayuki Ito for the vacant WBO super featherweight title. And, you know, Ito had like all of his fights over in Japan, losing one time by a majority decision, but had a string of TKO victories before this fight. And, I mean, here it just, you know, looked like, you know, Diaz had like a lot of, you know, a lot of hype behind him and stuff like that, but he was able to get a unanimous 12-round decision over Diaz to get that WBO title and give Diaz his first loss of his professional career. So that was pretty much what happened there on ESPN Plus. So that kind of like covers, you know, most of the major fights that happened over the weekend, right there. I'm pretty sure, like, you, I don't think you have ESPN Plus, do you?
Man, I messed around and did the trial and forgot to cancel it for 1 week, so they charged me for an extra week.
Oh, shoot. So, yeah, I mean, my thing was I did it for the for that Crawford Horn fight, and then, yeah, I had to make sure that I had to, you know, at least take it off for the time being because I was, like, you know, basically traveling, so had to make sure that was done. So that pretty much, like, covers what's going, what has happened over the course of the week. Next week, we're looking for the, like, a pretty busy card here. You have over in Uniondale, New York, Devin Alexander against Andre Berto, with the co-feature Peter Quillen against J. Leon Love, and over in Atlantic City, Sergey Kovalev faces Aleta Alvarez for the WBO light heavyweight title, and Dmitry Vivol faces Isaac Chalemba for the WBA light heavyweight title. So it's going to be a very busy weekend next week too. So it's something to basically look forward to here in the sport of boxing. Anything else you got there, Mike Grady?
I guess the main event of that fight is a pretty good fight. Tell me who fighting again. I'm sorry. I'm tripping. Tell me who fighting.
Tom, what's that?
Tell me who's fighting again. I forgot the two older guys who are fighting.
Yeah, you got, you know, Sergey Kovalev defending the WBO title against Eleanor Storm Alvarez. Of course, Eleanor Alvarez, it was a long time, very, very long time number one contender for the WBC light heavyweight title, but Yvonne Michelle wouldn't, you know, make the fight between him and Donna Stevenson. And so Alvarez is just sitting there and, you know, didn't have that fight against, Donna Stevenson. And so now he just ended up getting this fight with Sergey Kovalev, which is, you know, very weird seeing that Yvonne Michelle that was, you know, dealing with Alvarez couldn't get him a fight with Adonis Stevenson and couldn't get Adonis Stevenson to fight Sergey Kovalev, but this fight happens. Kind of like weird right there.
Yep. I think that should be... Actually, I've never seen Eleanor Alvarez fight for real, so I can't really call that one. But I'm thinking that Kovalev should win that fight. And isn't there another good boxing match on that card as well?
Dmitry Bivol will be facing Isaac Chalemba in the co-feature.
Okay, so that should be a decent test for Bivol. And I think Bivol can go 12 rounds pretty easily, right?
Yeah, Bivol can go 12 rounds easily, but he's, you know, had a string of fights where he doesn't need to go 12 rounds. So there's that.
Yeah. So I say that to say the fact that he can go 12 rounds easy means that he may have a better outcome than the other people who fought Chalemba, meaning he might knock out Chalemba because his win is such that he can keep it up. He can keep it up for 12 rounds versus Kovalev, you know, he gassing out at 9.
Right.
Which is still good, though.
Yeah, it's still good. But, Chalemba was able to get through, you know, 12 rounds with Sergey Kovalev before Kovalev took on Andre Ward. But, you know, I'm not sure where, you know, Chalemba is in this point of his career. This is going to be, you know, pretty much more than 2 years after that particular fight. He did lose. You know, he basically got, I would say, washed by Oleksandr Gvozdik. So after that, he did get a decision win over Blake Camporello, but I just don't see him really doing much against Dmitry Bivol in this particular fight.
Yeah, so I agree.
So that's what I got on that one. So that, yeah, that's what I'm basically covering. I will be, you know, pretty much see TMI. I'll be in attendance there over at Hard Rock over in Atlantic City for that particular fight card. So we'll see how that that comes out. We're going to, you know, have coverage, I would say, from probably from Friday, if not Friday, and then during the day Saturday before the actual card starts. So be on the lookout for that right there. On that note, I'm going to see if I could put in a close to this particular podcast of the Boxing Source Radio Show on the Go Long Media Channel on Blog Talk Radio. Catch the next show on Sunday after the fight cards that are going to be in Uniondale, New York, and in Atlantic City. We're going to be going through those. Catch the sister show here on, you know, Blog Talk Radio. The Cold Hard Truth on Sports with Matthew Long on Tuesday night around 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. So be sure to catch that. And I thank Mike Grady for calling in to this episode. And like I say at the end of every show, the point of boxing is a hit and not get hit, not to send and trade. On that note, I am out. Have a good evening, everybody.